Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The United States became the world's largest oil producer in 2014, according to a report by the BP Energy Company. BP economist Spencer Dale credits the shale revolution for a surge in American oil production that helped U.S. producers leapfrog over Saudi Arabia. American output of natural gas and oil combined is now greater than that of Russia, the previous global leader. In a presentation to energy experts in Washington, Dale said we are witnessing a changing of the guard in terms of global energy suppliers with profound implications. The U.S. now spends far less on oil energy imports, which once hurt the nation's balance of trade and the economy. The U.S. military chief said Thursday the United States is considering creating more train and advise hubs for Iraqi troops, even as it prepares to open a new base in Anbar province with 450 military personnel. It's another one of the options that we're considering, General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters in Naples, Italy, where he is meeting with U.S. commanders. Dempsey said examination of other sites beyond the new one near Ramadi, the provincial capital overrun by Islamic State insurgents last month, is just part of prudent planning. Chinese state media say former security chief Zhou Yongkang has been sentenced to life in prison following a secret trial. According to the Xinhua News Agency, Tianjin's Intermediate People's Court found Zhou guilty of corruption, abuse of power, and disclosing state secrets. Xinhua News Agency said the trial took place on May 22nd and that Zhou admitted his guilt. It also said that he does not plan to appeal the ruling. This is VOA News. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has made his first televised appearance since parliamentary elections results this week, calling for swift agreement among political parties to form a coalition government. Speaking on Turkish television Thursday, Mr. Erdogan said the four parties that won seats should leave egos aside, with understanding that continuity is a must for the state. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power urged the Ukrainian people to move from demanding change in their country to helping create it. Speaking to a large audience at the October Palace Cultural Center in the Ukrainian capital Kiev Thursday, she expressed U.S. support for the government and civil society-led reform process. She urged Ukrainians to remain engaged.
Building a system of new rules will never depend on what your government does, but rather what you make it do and what you do yourselves.
She said they must continue to make their voices heard to keep their leaders accountable, something she noted which is threatening to autocratic leaders like Russian President Vladimir Putin, who she said wants to sabotage their efforts. Leaders of Nigeria and four of its neighbors met Thursday to discuss a proposed joint force to fight Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. In opening remarks, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said his country should command the task force because it will provide the bulk of the troops and the main theater of the war is on Nigerian soil. He said a proposal to rotate the commander post between the countries every 6 months would make the task force less effective and efficient. Mr. Buhari also promised Nigeria will follow through on a pledge of $100 million to give the force a smooth launch. European leaders pressured debt-ridden Greece Thursday to reach a new deal to stave off a default on its loans, but the International Monetary Fund said there was no progress. We need decisions, not negotiations now, said Union President Donald Tusk. And it's my opinion that the Greek government has to be, I think, a little bit more realistic, he said. Tusk said a meeting in Luxembourg next Thursday of finance ministers from the 19 Eurozone countries would be really crucial in determining whether Greece's international creditors will unlock an $8 billion bailout segment in time for Athens to meet a $1.8 billion payment due one of its lenders, the International Monetary Fund, at the end of June. But an IMF spokesman said Greece and its creditors are well away from an agreement and that IMF negotiators in Brussels had returned to Washington. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Red Cross says food insecurity for more than 4 million people in South Sudan is near famine levels. It warns many people could face starvation if violence continues. An upsurge in violence is blamed for the displacement of about 100,000 people in the last 4 weeks.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details next.
Also, the UN Special Envoy to the Great Lakes has resigned as mediator of talks between rival political factions in Burundi. And a group of human rights organizations has complained to the Kenyan government about the harassment and intimidation of two non-governmental organizations.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Zambia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Red Cross says food insecurity for more than 4 million people in South Sudan is near famine levels. It warns many people could face starvation if violence continues. An upsurge in violence is blamed for the displacement of about 100,000 people in the last 4 weeks. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The latest displacement of South Sudanese is in addition to the 2 million already forced from their homes by a year and a half of conflict. In Juba, International Committee of the Red Cross spokesman Jason Strazuzo says many are fending for themselves in the bush.
In these areas, they simply don't have access to food, and we think that many of them are going to stay there for a long time in order to keep safe away from the fighting that's taking place. So we're worried about their nutritional situation in the coming weeks and months.
The displaced are in areas with little or no chance of having livelihoods, and there are rising food prices and few social services.
Generally speaking, it's the northeast part of the country. Specifically, we're looking at three states, Unity State, Upper Nile State, and Jonglei. And one of the locations we're most worried about is in Unity, around the town of Lair. We've had major operations there over the last year, distributing food to people who need it because there's no functioning market. Food is not making its way there, so it's simply not available.
Strazuzo says Red Cross operations have been affected by the fighting.
First of all, most importantly, we had to abandon our offices in Lair last month when violence approached the town. Our office is empty, and therefore our operations aren't working there. And what we do is medical and food in that region. We're still able to do some medical evacuations. We've done 3 medical evacuation flights from Lair in the last 2 weeks. And we're still doing emergency food drops.
One food drop last month aided about 6,000 people.
Importantly, you have to put the food where the people are. So we're working to find where the people are, and we hope to do more food distributions in the coming couple days.
However, he says airdrops are expensive and not sustainable in the long term for the numbers of people who need help.
We're looking at future problems as well because this is the planting season, and the people around Lair in particular who have fled, they're not planting, or if they did get a chance to plant, they're not tending to their crops.
One South Sudanese man told the Red Cross there's little incentive to plant or tend crops because people may soon be displaced again or lose their crops to bad weather. Strazuzo says the ICRC is making an emergency appeal for $23 million for its South Sudan operations.
Our South Sudan operations for the International Committee of the Red Cross are the second largest in the world behind our activities in Syria. And we're going to put these funds to more food distributions. We also distribute seeds. And, of course, we have 5 surgical teams out in the field who are operating on the people who are wounded in war. And just last month, they did many, many more of those emergency surgeries than they had for the rest of the year combined.
The Red Cross is calling on warring parties to respect international law and allow humanitarian workers and aid to reach those at risk. It says civilians are not part of the conflict and should never be targeted. In related news, the UN World Food Program says it plans to cut food rations to about 500,000 Somali and South Sudanese refugees in camps in northern Kenya. It blames that on a funding shortfall, adding it needs $12.5 million to avoid what it calls a critical food gap. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Special Envoy to the Great Lakes has resigned as mediator of talks between rival political factions in Burundi. 2 days ago, those opposed to President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a third term complained a UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, that Said Djanit favored the ruling party. The UN defended Djanit's role, but last night the UN mission in Burundi announced his resignation. Djanit maintains his position as UN representative to the Great Lakes region. Djanit was able to persuade the ruling party to delay elections for a few weeks, but not to withdraw Mr. Nkurunziza as a candidate in the July 15th elections. Parliamentary elections are now scheduled for June 29th. UN Human Rights Chief Zaid Raad Al-Hussein has voiced alarm over violent attacks against opposition leaders and protesters by the youth wing of the ruling party. More than 20 have died in clashes with police in Bujumbura since April 25th. That's when Mr. Nkurunziza announced he would run again for president. Nearly 100,000 people have fled to neighboring Tanzania, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
In Nigeria, three women wearing explosive vests blew up on the road to Maiduguri yesterday. There were no other casualties reported. The explosion occurred as the women walked through the village of Ano. The local police commissioner said they were walking to Maiduguri, which is a city of more than 1 million people and the birthplace of Boko Haram. A munitions expert believes many of the explosives worn by Boko Haram suicide bombers are detonated by remote control, not by those wearing the vest of explosives. Suicide attacks have increased in this portion of northeast Nigeria, where regional militaries are battling to retake communities from Boko Haram.
Burial teams undertook some of the most hazardous work in Liberia's fight against Ebola. With the West African nation now getting relief from the virus, these men and women say societal stigma is keeping them from getting jobs. Chris Stein reports from Dakar with Prince Collins in Monrovia, Liberia.
At the height of Liberia's Ebola virus outbreak, Emmanuel Johnson left his potato farm and undertook the grim and dangerous job of burying the victims of the virus. More than 4,800 people would die of the disease in the country. The World Health Organization declared the outbreak in Liberia over last month, but that has not been good news for Johnson. Though he was never infected, he says the stigma associated with his old job, burying the dead, keeps him from getting work.
And I get work, and I get farm. My farmland, the people take their land back. But now, I'm just passing all over looking for jobs. Nobody won't give me jobs. Some people are afraid to give me job because they fear I will get in Ebola.
Burial workers like Johnson undertook some of the most vital and hazardous work during Liberia's outbreak. Ebola is transmitted through contact with body fluids. Safely burying the bodies of the deceased was key to ridding the country of Ebola. But it was also among the riskiest work, since the bodies of Ebola victims are highly infectious. Being unemployed is no small thing in Liberia, which was already recovering from nearly two decades of ruinous civil war before Ebola broke out in 2014. About two-thirds of Liberians live in poverty, according to the World Bank. Sonny Fayon was unemployed when the outbreak started. He found work on a burial team, but is now out of a job again. Even though he never got sick, no one will hire him, he says.
We're not very vulnerable to the Ebola business. We're well protected. We wore protective clothing to do the job, so they should accept us. Ali, we're very careful in doing the work.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies was one of the organizations that employed burial teams. Program coordinator Adimola Alau says even though none of their workers got the virus, they are still being stigmatized.
You know, because of the stigmatization and then their engagement in the dead body management, it was really difficult for them to go back and engage in their normal business.
The Red Cross put about 140 people to work burying bodies during the outbreak. Alao says some of them have continued working with the group as drivers or community workers, now that the outbreak is over. While Liberia is no longer being ravaged by Ebola, new cases of the virus have recently been reported in neighboring Sierra Leone and Guinea. In total, the disease has killed over 11,000 people in the three West African countries. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Coming up on 16 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, a group of human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and Kenya's National Civil Society Congress, has complained to the Kenyan government about the harassment and intimidation of two non-governmental organizations. In a statement released today, the groups criticized Nairobi for freezing the bank accounts of the groups Haki Africa and Muslims for Human Rights, also known as Muhuri. The statement said Kenya has placed the two groups on an official list of alleged supporters of terrorism. Kenya's National Regulatory Authority for Non-Governmental Groups canceled the registration of the two organizations on May 28th, claiming they underreported their income. But the human rights groups dispute that, saying Haki Africa and Muhuri were operating openly as part of other organizations and have consistently filed tax returns with the board and posted the returns online. The two Mombasa-based groups say they have been consistently documenting human rights abuses in Kenya's coastal region and have also raised allegations that security agencies have engaged in extrajudicial killings of Muslim clerics and alleged terrorism suspects. Amnesty International Regional Director for East Africa, Butoni Wanyeki, said rather than investing time and resources in targeting the two NGOs, Kenyan authorities should focus on addressing the concerns they have been raising. Kenya's NGO Corruption Board has not made a public response.
More than 600 migrants were rescued from the Aegean Sea as increasing numbers sail north into Greek waters. Greek authorities say they have received more than 50,000 migrants in the last 5 months, more than they received in all of 2014. Greece is quickly catching up with Italy, which has borne the brunt of a two-year exodus from Syria and many African countries. The UN Refugee Agency says total migration on the Mediterranean this year has topped 100,000. European Union officials hope to meet next Tuesday in Luxembourg to resolve a dispute among 28 member countries about whether to accept refugee quotas. The EU has also begun increased search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean. More than 2,000 migrants are believed to have drowned in the past 5 months.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Red Cross says food insecurity for more than 4 million people in South Sudan is near famine levels. The UN Special Envoy to the Great Lakes has resigned as mediator of talks between rival political factions in Burundi. And a group of human rights organizations has complained to the Kenyan government about the harassment and intimidation of two non-governmental organizations. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Leading animal welfare organizations have united to support legislation banning the sale of ivory and rhinoceros horn in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. The state Senate and House bill was introduced by Senator Jason Lewis and Representative Lori Ehrlich and is a crucial step in the fight to save African elephants and rhinos. The two species are being killed at unprecedented rates as the demand for their tusks and horns increases. One animal welfare organization that supports the bill is the Washington, D.C.-based Born Free USA. Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me about why the law is needed in Massachusetts.
Well, right now, what we've found is that ivory is coming into the United States, both legally and illegally, including ports of entry such as Boston's Logan Airport. And we think that all across the United States, you have a situation where America has essentially become probably the number two ivory importer behind China. And so both the United States government and the individual state legislatures across the country need to take the responsibility to try and stop domestic ivory markets as a way of saving elephants in the wild.
Now, you say it is coming into the ports legally and illegally.
That's right. You'll have some antiques, certified antiques, or hunting trophies. When someone goes to a country in Africa and hunts an elephant, they usually bring back the tusk as a trophy. And so those things can be legal, and these products can come into the country. But then there's also significant seizures of jewelry, trinkets, piano keys, et cetera, that are being confiscated at the ports of entry as well. So part of the problem with the ivory trade right now is that it's very hard to tell legal from illegal ivory. And once you get something into the country, it can be sold illegally but fraudulently as a legal product.
Your organization, Born Free USA, is supporting this bill. So how would it be applied if it is passed?
Well, importantly, it would prevent people in Massachusetts from importing, selling, purchasing, bartering, or even possessing ivory or rhino horn. And that's another important part, that it does include rhino horn, and rhinos are obviously incredibly imperiled in the wild right now. So it prevents all of that activity within the state of Massachusetts, thereby preventing people in Massachusetts from contributing to the ongoing poaching crisis of both elephants and rhinos throughout Africa.
What type of U.S. legislation is also taking place regarding the sale of illegal ivory and rhinoceros horn?
There are sort of two bills that are pending in Congress right now. One would make poaching much more difficult in Africa because it would make penalties for people who poach much more significant. In other words, this bill that Congressman Peter DeFazio has introduced from Oregon called the Tusker Act would look at countries that are implicated in allowing elephant ivory to be sold or rhino horn to be exported and making sure that we're able to put sanctions on those countries easier as a way of trying to crack down and push countries around Africa to do more to stop poaching. And then there are other bills that are coming up. So you really see sort of right now this federal impetus to do more. And, of course, all of this feeds off the Obama administration, which has issued an executive order, set up an advisory council on wildlife trafficking, and is really, you know, putting some significant government effort behind trying to stop the ivory and rhino horn trade.
How is poaching contributing towards terrorism and government corruption?
Actually, the question could really be turned around a bit. It's that government corruption and poaching are contributing to the decline of elephants in the wild. You've got situations that in places like Zimbabwe and Tanzania, it's really a bit lawless. So in Zimbabwe, you've got significant government corruption. You have government leaders who are owning lands where poaching takes place and profiting by the sale of ivory. In Tanzania, we've got significant declines of elephant populations, especially in places like the Selous Reserve, and again, a Tanzanian government implicated in corruption. So that contributes to and facilitates not only poaching, but the movement of ivory from the field to the marketplace. But then a lot of places in Africa, you have some significant instability because you've got these terrorist outfits that are killing elephants, selling the ivory, and using a portion of the proceeds, at least, to fund their nefarious and deadly activities.
What then would this bill mean for the elephants and rhinoceros in Africa?
Well, I think every piece of legislation that's introduced to try and stop the sale of ivory and to stop the sale of rhino horn is going to make a positive contribution to conservation on the ground, because it's going to help dry up the different markets around the country or around the world for these products. And obviously, if there's no market for the product any longer, then there's no profitability in selling ivory or selling rhino horn. And if you remove the profitability, you remove the incentive to kill elephants and rhinos. But it actually does a second thing, which is really important on a political level, and that is that so much focus has been placed in the past few years on China and trying to stop the Chinese consumption of ivory, the Chinese sale of ivory. But obviously, they're only one part of the problem. They may be the most significant significant and major part of the problem, but we have to show in America that we're willing to step up and pass state and federal legislation to do our part to stop the domestic sale of ivory and help these animals in the wild.
Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
African leaders have agreed to create the continent's largest free trade zone. It includes the economies of 26 countries and more than half of Africa's gross domestic product. The agreement signed yesterday in Cairo is designed to boost the movement of goods within three existing trade zones and lower the price of manufactured goods for more than 600 million Africans. The tripartite free trade area will be unveiled at the upcoming summit of the African Union this weekend in South Africa.
Thousands of children in developing nations such as Uganda are born with heart problems, and thousands more contract heart diseases in their youth. An American cardiologist has taken it upon himself to see that Ugandan children get the treatment they need. VOA's Mike Richmond has more on this doctor with a huge heart.
It's been a busy day for pediatric cardiologist Craig Sable at the Uganda Heart Institute at Mulago National Referral Hospital in the capital, Kampala. He has examined a number of children with serious heart ailments and overseen medical procedures on them, like 4-year-old Victoria here.
She'll hopefully outlive us all. Take really good care of her and make sure she recovers okay.
This experience is nothing new for Sable, who has been leading medical missions here for more than a decade.
In Uganda,
many Ugandan children are born with health defects such as holes in their heart, while others are stricken with rheumatic heart diseases in their youth. Sable selects patients for operations and serves as a consultant to American and Ugandan surgeons before, during, and after procedures. He has overseen about 500 open-heart surgeries on Ugandan children with a 95% survival rate, which, as he put it, is almost as good as it gets in the United States.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Okay?
I think it's probably a good idea.
So we put the needle in here, draw out. When you get fluid, you undo your needle. You take this wire, you put the wire in, like you're in the cath lab, okay? I think the most striking thing to me is when I walk into the waiting room and see 50 to 100 children who I know if they were here, they would get fixed, and I know that we have a chance to help them.
Ugandan cardiologist Twalib Aliku has learned a lot from his American counterpart.
Basically, he started the program when we couldn't do any surgeries on our own, and we've reached this point where we are doing many surgeries on our own as a country. So, I mean, it's just tremendous what he's done.
Sable says he will continue his efforts to modernize Uganda's pediatric cardiology system.
My hope is they can transition from being a fledgling program that does a few heart surgeries to become a model for the region and other parts of the developing world that we can do meaningful research and innovative program implementation that other programs can copy, and they can go from being the helpers to the leaders.
The 52-year-old doctor still has time for his practice at the National Children's Medical Center in Washington, but he'll be heading off on his next mission to Uganda in July. Mike Richmond, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
News is happening. VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all. on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Red Cross says food insecurity for more than 4 million people in South Sudan is near famine levels. The UN Special Envoy to the Great Lakes has resigned as mediator of talks between rival political factions in Burundi. And a group of human rights organizations has complained to the Kenyan government about the harassment and intimidation of two non-governmental organizations. Coming up, we'll have music from Zambia and, in our feature segment, recovering from armed conflict in Senegal. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have a preview of Thursday's Women's World Cup football matches.
Kim, first round group action continues Thursday at the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. There are four fixtures scheduled. In the first match of the day, Germany plays Norway in Ottawa, Canada. The two-time world champion German women trounced Ivory Coast 10-0 in their opening game, while the Norwegians topped Thailand 4-0. In Thursday's second match, China challenges the Netherlands in the Western Canadian city of Edmonton. The Chinese lost to host Canada 1-0 in their opening match in Edmonton, while the Dutch ladies defeated New Zealand by that same 1-0 scoreline. In another game in Ottawa, World Cup debutante Ivory Coast will try to bounce back from that big loss to the Germans when the African side takes on Thailand. And in Thursday's final match in Edmonton, host Canada goes for its second straight victory when it plays New Zealand. And speaking of New Zealand, the field for the quarterfinals at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup for men in New Zealand is now set after Thursday's action. Brazil, Portugal, Uzbekistan, and Germany all advanced to the last eight with victories Thursday. The Brazilian boys beat South American rival Uruguay 5-4 on penalty kicks after a scoreless draw during regulation and extra time. Portugal eliminated host New Zealand 2-1. Uzbekistan beat Austria 2-0. And European champion Germany ousted African champion Nigeria 1-0 in Christchurch, New Zealand, on a goal by Levan Ostenali in the 19th minute. Sam Audu is the media officer for the Flying Eagles of Nigeria. Our friend in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, called Sam in Christchurch and asked him what went wrong.
We lost the game, especially the first half. We didn't start early. We didn't start well. The Germans capitalized on our slow start and could have even won the game hands down by the first half. Second half, we chased the game, and they were just too professional and too tactical for us. And then we were out. We are going to go home. We wanted to be the last team to go back home from New Zealand, but we are going home early.
Since reaching the quarterfinals of the tournament in 2011, Nigeria has not advanced beyond the round of 16 in subsequent tournaments, including the ongoing one in New Zealand. Is this an indication that the standard of play of our national under-20 team, the Flying Eagles, is going down?
You can't take it like that. I think that we have to really do some investigations, find out what really is the problem, you know, because really we've done well in under 17, but then when it comes to under 20, we seem to struggle. We've qualified for the last 10 under 20 tournaments, so to speak, but we've not gone beyond the quarterfinals. So it's something to worry about, and I think it's something that we need to look at, you know, critically.
Now that the team is out of the ongoing tournament in New Zealand, what's next?
Well, it's down to the NFF to decide on what next to do with the team. But I know a lot of these players, most of them will go to the Olympic team, which is still in training camp. They have the All-Africa Games. They also have the qualifiers for the Rio Olympics. So most of those boys, I want to believe, will be drafted to do under-23 team.
That's Sam Audu, the media officer for Nigeria's national under-20 football team, nicknamed the Flying Eagles. And Sam spoke by telephone from Christchurch, New Zealand, with our friend in Lagos, Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on. This is cool. Just come out and play with me.
This is gonna go.
Just come out and play with me.
This is gonna work.
Just come out and play with
me. This is gonna go.
Hey.
This is gonna work.
Just come out and play with me.
This is gonna go.
Just come out and play with me.
This is gonna work.
Just
game on, VOA sports fans. As I reported during Wednesday's Sunny Side of Sports, FIFA has postponed the bidding process for the 2026 World Cup amid the bribery allegations engulfing world football's governing body. The United States had been seen as a front runner for hosting the competition. Henry Ridgewell reports from London on the latest corruption claims sending shockwaves through the football world.
While FIFA may be paralyzed by the allegations of corruption in the Russian city of Samara, construction continues on the 45,000-seat stadium scheduled to host some of the games of the 2018 World Cup. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valcke toured the venue Tuesday amid accusations of bribery in the bids to host the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. FIFA announced the bidding process for the 2026 event would be postponed.
Due to the situation, I think it's a nonsense to start any bidding process for the time being.
FIFA's rotation policy means the 2026 World Cup is due to be held in the Americas, with the United States seen as a front-runner. Postponing the bidding process is logical, says Martin Lipton of Britain's Sun newspaper.
If there's going to be a change of venue for 2022, then the needs of rotation mean that you have to change the list of potential bidders for 2026.
Lipton says the tight timescale means it is unlikely the 2018 World Cup bidding process will be rerun, despite allegations of corruption. Russia's sports minister Vitaly Mutko rejected accusations of bribery.
Мы действовали в рамках того регламента, который был. Могу вас заверить.
He said that Russia acted within regulations that existed at the time. If something did happen, he said, then it would have been revealed within 2 or 3 years. Qatar's hosting of the 2022 World Cup is less certain, says veteran football journalist Martin Lipton.
There's a huge demand from the European clubs and associations and leagues to move from a winter tournament back to the traditional summer tournament. The doubts about the probity of the voting process continue to be raised and strengthened. And I think it's moving towards a position where 2022 will eventually be moved.
Qatar's foreign minister Khalid bin Mohammed Al Attiyah denied the allegations of bribery and accused rival bidders of anti-Arab prejudice.
Some entities, some countries, they don't like to see an Arab state in the Middle East hosting a tournament as such for the Arab world.
Qatar is facing further criticism over the safety of workers on World Cup construction sites. The International Trade Union Confederation predicts that up to 4,000 migrants could die by tournament kickoff in 2022. Workers are also denied basic rights, says Mustafa Kadri of Amnesty International.
They're not free to choose their employer often, to change their employer, to leave the country when they want. To complain about their conditions can often result in them being detained by the police.
Qatar says it has hired labour inspectors and built new worker accommodations. But if the corruption allegations are proven, the huge construction projects could be a waste of money and human lives. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Hey, mates, remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA.
VOA!
And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty. While Nigeria is now out of the FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand, West African neighbors Mali and Senegal will be waving the African flag in Sunday's quarterfinals. The Malian boys beat Ghana Wednesday 3-0 in Wellington, New Zealand, while Senegal defeated Ukraine 3-1 on penalty kicks in Auckland, New Zealand. The Senegalese will now travel to Wellington, where they'll play Uzbekistan on Sunday. Mali, meanwhile, is matched against Germany in Christchurch. In the two other quarterfinals, Brazil will play Portugal in Hamilton, New Zealand, and the USA will face Serbia in Auckland. Neighbors Mali and Senegal are trying to become the second African team to lift the FIFA Under-20 trophy. The Black Satellites of Ghana won the title in 2009 in Egypt, where they beat Brazil on penalty kicks in the final. The National Basketball Association finals resume later Thursday night in Cleveland, Ohio, where the Cleveland Cavaliers will host the Golden State Warriors in Game 4 of the Best of 7 Championship Series. The Cavaliers, led by superstar LeBron James, lead the finals 2-1. LeBron has been sensational so far. He scored 123 points, the most ever, for the first three games of the NBA Finals. All three games have been close. The first two games went to overtime, with Golden State winning Game 1 and Cleveland Game 2. In Game 3, the Warriors trailed by 20 points in the second half, made a big rally, and pulled to within 1 point with 2 minutes and 45 seconds remaining before losing 96-91. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the fourth part of a series on Johannesburg. And next, Senegal recovering from armed conflict. But first, the music. It is Nalu of Zambia with For Better or Worse.
Thank you.
Nalu of Zambia with For Better or Worse.
Well, South Africa's largest metropolis, Johannesburg, rose out of a gold rush in the late 1800s. Bars and gentlemen's clubs quickly opened to slake the thirst of miners and prospectors. However, most of those establishments were replaced by fancy franchise bars. But there's one pub in central Johannesburg that's been serving patrons for more than a century. Darren Taylor takes us inside the Guildhall Bar in the fourth part of a series about reminders of Johannesburg's past.
Tokozane Nkomalo fixes a drink over a long bar counter made of antique wood that's a luxuriant deep red-brown color. Lamps hanging over him cast dim yellow light onto dull brass panels that line the counter. This is the Guildhall Bar in Harrison Street in inner city Johannesburg, where Nkomalo's on a first-name basis with all the regulars.
Steve, Mike, Chris, Jackie.
He says some of them have been drinking here for 50 years. He knows their favorite drinks, but he's a lifelong teetotaler.
No, I'm not drinking.
I mean, you're a barman all day long, but you don't drink.
Since I was born, I never drink it. I never tasted the beers.
Nkumalo says he's proud to work at the Guildhall.
It's the oldest bar in Joburg since 1888. So now it's 127 years.
The pub opened 2 years after gold was discovered in Johannesburg. But don't ask its current owner, Fernando Coimbra, for a history lesson.
Well, about the history, I don't know much about history because me and history, we're not very good friends.
Nevertheless, the stout, raven-haired man of Portuguese descent is aware that the Guildhall's first customers were dusty miners and the outlaws and outcasts that accompanied Johannesburg's gold rush. Later, says Coimbra, the bar attracted more refined customers.
This used to be like a gentleman's pub. From what I've heard, yes, the lawyers and the judges and big boys used to come and drink here.
One of those big boys was one of South Africa's first mining magnates, Barney Barnato. Today, the Guildhall's clientele includes people who work in nearby banks and courts, and officials from the headquarters of the ruling African National Congress Party, which is a block away.
For me, it's like a privilege being associated with the oldest bar in the whole of Joburg.
Office clerk A.B. Tswai is 30, but already has 10 years of patronage at the Guildhall under his designer leather belt. He's dressed stylishly in a white shirt, shiny blue pants, and pointy Italian leather shoes. Tswai says he frequents this bar because it has culture, and he learns a lot from its older customers.
The last guy I met has been drinking here since from 1976. So they'll tell you all about the history of the place and all that. That's why you get to like the place.
You're leaning on a bar that was first built in 1888. Does that mean something to you?
It does, really, because even myself, I had to take some pictures of this place so I can even, you know, when my children are grown one day, I'll show them as well that, you know, this is one of those oldest bar in Joburg, and I was part of it, really.
In the late 1800s, men drinking at the Guildhall were lucky to be offered stale bread to wash down with the beer they quaffed. Now, the menu's a reflection of the new owner's Portuguese heritage. Translucent tentacles fly as Coimbra tenderizes a whole octopus and chops potatoes with a huge knife that looks older than his bar.
Today I'm doing an octopus, cooking two baby octopus with roasted potatoes.
Very traditional dish for this place, am I right?
Not really.
Yeah, I very much doubt that baby octopus was available in 1888 over here in Market Street in Johannesburg.
Probably not at that time, I don't know.
Entertainment at the Guildhall has also modernized.
DJs make it a very different place from the days when the only sounds inside its cavernous interior were chatter from inebriated miners and the clatter of horse-drawn carts in nearby Market Street.
They've got karaoke on Thursdays, you know, where the ladies, beautiful ladies, nice ladies will come sing here, you know. So it's a good thing, eh?
To say I love you would be a big old lie.
In days gone by, the bar was infamous for brawls. Now, says Tsui, it's a place of peace.
You know, it's a different environment, really. I've never been in a place same as this in Joburg. You know, mixed races, you know, everybody just come together. Never had a single fight in a single day here.
Tsui says he doesn't mind drinking in the shadows of photographs of British colonialists on the walls. He smirks and says, yes, they did bad, but they also did good, like they built this pub. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News at the Guildhall Bar in Johannesburg.
Since an armed conflict shook the southern region of Senegal in the late 1990s, the area has suffered severe economic hardship. Reporter Mel Bailey takes a look at how the region of Casamance is recovering.
In Casamance, the sub-region of Senegal, locals and activists are urging refugees to come back and start rebuilding after over 70% of the population fled some 30 years ago due to a rebel uprising caused by opposing views on regional succession from the country. Since then, the economic development of the region has halted. Moussa Daidu, native of the village Mungulan, fled and was displaced for 10 years.
I want to ask everyone from the community to come back to where they were. If no one comes back, it won't be Casamance anymore. But if people come back to where they were before, to start working and try to forget what happened, it can be Casamance again. Each year, if you come back to what was left aflame and start to build again, that will be Casamance. I want to tell everyone who comes from the region to come back and work, come back and rebuild our home.
Political activists and nonprofit organizations estimate that today nearly 80% of families who could have returned to their native villages. But vendor Malik Ngam says, economically, Casamance is very far off from where it once was.
Before, when you sold a product, there were so many people to sell to, but now the clientele is gone. They've all fled. The other difference is that us, the people of the village, weren't afraid to go into the forest to get what we used to sell, banana leaves, fruit, etc. But now, because of the conflict, people are still worried about going into the forest to get anything. It's impacting the local economy.
The Association for Rural Promotion for the District of Niassia has been active in peace talks and refugee placement for over 15 years. They have discovered that financial partners, like citizens, want to come back to the region, and they are working to reassure everyone that soon Casamance will again be a peaceful region.
We are advocating for the stability of the region so the financial partners come back to Casamance. There is the want, the desire, to turn one's back on the crisis, on everything that has happened.
Approximately 78 villages have completely disappeared from the map of Senegal. At least 150,000 people have lost everything. But rebuilding and demining throughout the region persists. And the population is hopeful that soon, with partners like Apran, Casamance will once again flourish.
That was reporter Mel Bailey reporting from Senegal. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As African leaders continue working to end the political crisis in Burundi, the United States again calls on President Pierre Nkurunziza to respect the term limit provision of the Arusha Agreement in order to restore stability and help his country heal after weeks of violence. With his controversial candidacy threatening to undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress, the president must consider how his attempt to retain power will affect the future of his country and his legacy. East African leaders from Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya, along with South African President Jacob Zuma, met May 31st in Tanzania to discuss the crisis, following an earlier summit on May 13th. They called for the postponement of elections by at least a month and a half to create the right conditions for voting, as well as disarming the ruling party's youth militias. Protests erupted in Burundi in late April in response to Nkurunziza's decision to run for another term in June 26 polls. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. The United States government's position remains that the Arusha Agreement must be respected and that any violation of Arusha seriously undermines Burundi's stability. The conditions for free, fair, transparent, and credible elections do not currently exist due to the closure of political space, the shutting down of independent media, the government's violent response to political protests, and continuing reports of violence and intimidation by armed youth militia. These policies are not in accord with the principles of a democratic country, especially one facing national elections. The United States calls for restraint by all Burundian stakeholders and regional partners. We urge all parties to continue to support the ongoing peaceful efforts to find a solution that is in accord with the Arusha Agreement, and to refrain from any acts that could contribute to the climate of instability or undermine the rule of law in Burundi.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.